Well, oh. Great. Oh, so the people who are in the room can see me and the camcorder can see me, but not the remote participant. I guess that's all right. So they can hear me, right?
We can hear you.
And here's Greg. Perfect timing. I'm about to introduce Joe. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Joe Nash. On the last day of Code Yellow, you're not required to wear a mask in the room. I've been tested twice over Easter weekend, so I'm pretty confident I'm not infecting anyone here. So Joe came to us from Michigan Technical University. Did you all know that he was the outstanding senior forester of 2020? Joe is very modest. I didn't know that until I read the CV and his thesis. But we really appreciate Joe's forestry expertise, and he couldn't have done this project without it, leading many novice interns in a remote part of New Hampshire, very remote part of New Hampshire. Some of the sites were selected by Tony Federer, who's a world champion orienteer, and you have to ford a river. I don't know if you're gonna get into that when you tell us about your sites. Joe came to us from Michigan Technical University because he was working with Marty Jurgensen and Chris Miller on wood stakes, preparing wood stakes, excavating wood stakes, weighing and dissecting wood stakes for decomposition. So when I learned he was interested in wood and he learned about our project, he took on this topic. It was very timely for us because it had been studied repeatedly over the years and never published, including, as you'll see, some work from a student thesis at another university. So we're very glad that Joe took it on. I also want to mention Joe's emotional intelligence index or social intelligence. So Joe makes us all feel good. Joe can make a field crew work well. You guys are going to be channeling for Joe's. So please welcome Joe Nash. His title is Down in the Debris, Forest Development and Tree Biomass in the White Mountains. Take it away, Joe.
Thank you, Ruth. Thanks for that great introduction. Well, to start off, I want to talk a little bit about forest succession. And so this is a great figure from Oliver and Larson's Forest Stand Dynamics, depicting the progression or the idealized progression of a forest stand after a major disturbance. And so after a stand replacing disturbance where most of the overstory is removed, or in this case, the entire overstory, we start with a stand initiation phase where shade intolerant, fast growing species quickly dominate the canopy. But as resources become limiting, we enter the stem exclusion phase where a lot of these early successional species die and lose their canopy dominance mostly as a result of increased competition for light. Depending on how much light gets back into the understory from individual tree death, we may enter this understory reinitiation phase, followed by an old growth phase, which is characterized by a very vertically stratified canopy. But the progression of this succession in forests is dominated by the frequency and intensity of disturbances. So this here shows the stand's resistance to a disturbance and the annual fluctuations that that stand may come in contact with throughout the years. Sometimes, in many cases, the stand is not completely removed to the point where you restart the successional pathway, but these disturbances play a big role in the dynamics within the stand. And we can think of disturbances largely in these two categories, autogenic and allogenic. Auto being disturbances that are created from within the stand, such as cell thinning, and allogenic being from outside the stand, as is the case with wind, throw, and ice storms. And it's important to note here that many disturbances can be kind of a gray area between these two classifications. For example, invasive pests and disease may come from outside the stand, but the reaction of the stand to that disturbance is largely based on the stand's susceptibility, which is defined by conditions within the stand. So here's a very nice figure that shows the above ground biomass and the progression of above ground biomass in stands according to the stand age. And what's important to note here is that results have differed in what we see with stand.
That's Joe Nash.
Good. It's progressing after a major disturbance. And so this line here, A, is from the widely cited Borman and Likens paper, which modeled above ground biomass in late stands. But the data here was just from early, younger stands at Hubbard Brook. And this Fahey et al. Paper actually looked at watershed 6 at Hubbard Brook more recently and found that biomass is actually leveling off and potentially showing signs of declines much earlier than anticipated or predicted by Borman and Likens. And line C here is from a compilation of data sources, many of which we have Dr. McGee to thank for, showing stands that developed and accumulated biomass very late in this stand development. And the time since the disturbance also has a great impact on the downed wood in the stand, or the downed woody debris. And this figure over here shows the downed wood at the time of major disturbance, such as a clear cut. And that legacy wood, So that legacy wood, as it decomposes, decreases, and this is woody biomass. And then as the stand grows and accumulates more wood and more trees die, that new de novo wood is added. And both of those combined create the total downed wood within a stand. So why am I talking about downed wood? Well, downed wood is extremely important ecologically for a number of reasons. It's a great habitat for wildlife and especially hosts a diversity of fungi. It's also a great germination site for mosses and especially small seeded trees that are able to get lodged in the cracks of decomposing woody debris, which has a very high moisture content. It's also a nutrient sink and then subsequently a source during decomposition. And that also plays a major role in carbon dynamics and soil formation, especially the organic horizons of soils. Sorry about that, everybody. Thank you, Russ. Hide this. Okay, so as I was saying, the decomposition process of downed woody debris occurs across a continuum. But as with continuums, it's very difficult to quantify that. And so we use decay classes, very commonly decay classes 1 through 5, one being structurally sound wood, fresh wood that has just recently fallen to the forest floor, and 5 being heavily decayed wood that has lost all structural stability. And decay class is very meaningful because it's a good metric to understand wood density, which is pretty difficult to measure in the field, but it's a very important metric, especially for the conversion of volume, which is very easy to measure, to biomass. And density is very variable. It's variable across species, but it's also variable within species, as these figures here show. So this figure to the right shows the mean density on the y-axis by decay class. And you can see that hardwoods are generally higher density than softwoods, but even within both of those groups, there's quite a bit of variability. And we generally see a decrease in density as the wood decays, which is intuitive. As I mentioned before, downed wood is very important globally as a carbon sink and source. And we generally think of wood to be 50% carbon. And you can see here from this figure on the right, the significance that this plays in the total carbon within a forest. It may seem small compared to above ground and soil, but it's a very meaningful source nonetheless.
I know, is there a room? Oh yeah. What are the choices for viewing?
Thanks. And the biggest source of uncertainty in the carbon storage of downwood is the density, by far. And so this is why we're so interested in measuring density and doing it correctly and accurately. So I started off a little bit ago talking about forced succession. And this is a process that occurs over many years. And as a result, it's very difficult to study it directly. Unless you can go back to the same stand over 100 years or more, it's very difficult to see how that stand might be progressing. So the way that we get around this is by using chronosequence. And a chronosequence is just a number of sites that have developed under similar climatic and edaphic conditions, but differ since the time of a stand replacing disturbance. And this is from the very famous Covington paper, which looked at organic matter and organic mass in soils across a range of sites. And following that Covington paper, Tony Federer used a different chronosequence of sites, but in the same region, to try and confirm or deny what Covington reported with the very low levels of organic mass after clear cutting. And interestingly, Federer saw a very similar pattern, but his lowest lows were not as low as Covington saw, and Covington reported in the 81 study. And perhaps more importantly, immediately after clear cut, the levels that Federer saw were lower than predicted by Covington. And the point of this is just that the results of interpreting a chronosequence can vary. And so it's important to test to try to confirm or deny any predictions. And that's exactly what was done with this paper and by Yana and others in 2003. And they saw in the same stands that Tony Federer sampled organic matter in, they went back to see if these sites followed the predicted pathway. And so these lines on this figure are the predicted changes in organic mass, and the solid lines are the observed. And so it's, again, important to note that through repeated measures, we can either confirm or deny past predictions. And that's exactly what I'm attempting to do with this paper. And so in 2004, Marty Acker used a chronosequence of sites across the White Mountains and the same sites that I revisited in 2020 and 2021. And he looked at fine woody debris and coarse woody debris. And so coarse down woody debris is very normally separated into these fine and coarse categorizations. These are the same diameter cutoffs used by the Forest Service for the FIA, the Forest Inventory and Analysis Program, or at least they were at the time. And this figure on the right here shows the triangles being Marty's observations in these chronosequence stands, and all of the other symbols being other sites across the White Mountains, and how his predicted, or how his observed values compare to theirs. And I resampled these sites to determine how the volume might be changing. After Marty's 2004 sampling, Matt Vadebonker looked at the smaller than 3 centimeters, which was the bottom of Marty's fine woody debris, to determine how the mass of twigs in these sites compared, or compared to the coarser components. And so you can see the white bars on top of Marty's coarse and fine are Matt's twig masses in these sites. And I sampled twigs as well in 2020. It's a slightly different method to sample the smaller component, and I'll get into that in a minute. So the objectives of this study were to describe how the volume, biomass, species composition, and decay classes of downed wood vary with stand development, particularly in comparison to the standing tree composition and biomass. It was also aiming to determine if coarse and fine woody debris reached stable state conditions at different timescales due to the change during overstory succession to larger trees. And I also hope to establish a classification of the species composition, size distribution, and state of decay of down woody debris at these different stages in northern hardwoods. A few hypotheses. I expected that the total volume would increase with stand age intuitively as larger trees die. There's larger logs on the forest floor and hence larger volumes. I also expected to find a relationship with fine woody debris, the smaller component, and stand age, particularly from establishment to about 30 to 50 years, when especially pin cherry seems to drop out of the canopy. And I also expected to see a higher contribution of beech to the total down woody debris in the mature forests compared to the other shade tolerant climax species such as sugar maple, particularly due to the influence of beech bark disease in these stands. So here we are in the Northeast. Here's our sites. We have 16 chronosequence sites in total throughout the White Mountains. There's six of them directly in Bartlett Experimental Forest, another eight in the surrounding White Mountains. We've got one site at Hubbard Brook. And then in 2021, we also added two old growth sites in the White Mountains, the Bowl and Mountain Pond. So I'm very fortunate that there was many people ahead of me that had implemented a lot of work in these stands that made it possible for me to come in and resample. And so I owe them a lot of gratitude. These live trees in these stands were inventoried in 1994, 2003, 2012, and then we followed up in 2021. And the coarse and fine components were sampled in 2004, and then in 2020, and then 2021 in just the old growth sites. And twigs were sampled in 2006, and then in 2020, I followed up with twig sampling. I do want to note here that the old growth stands, because they were just added this past summer, were only sampled once. And so, as I said, one of the strengths of this study was the repeated measures, which we lack in the old growth stands. Here's our standard design for all of our sites. There are a couple exceptions where the stands are about 33.3 meters in length, 33 meters, as opposed to the standard 50 meters, but most of them are 50 by 50. We did the old growth stands a half a hectare in size, so that's why those are 70.7 by 70.7. In all of the stands, we measured all of the trees greater than 10 centimeters within 5 meters of the transect. And there was five of the transects within each site. And then down woody debris, we inventoried using line intersect sampling. And if you're not familiar with line intersect sampling, it's a great way to estimate the volume of down woody debris in a site just based on the intersections that wood makes with your transect. And we use this formula on the right here, which takes the diameter intersection, calculates the projected elliptical cross section. And when you sum those, you can estimate the volume within a site. And this is what that looks like. We're actually running out the transect and measuring the wood that we intersect. Here's our general down woody debris sampling design for the coarse and fine components. We use this cluster here in the center for the majority of our stands. These two exceptions on the right are where stand size or skid trail did not permit the standard use of the cluster. Otherwise, we used three clusters in each stand, four in the old growth. And each leg of the cluster here is a transect separated by 120 degrees, which was randomized. We did not sample within the first 5 meters of the transect. On the next 5 meters, we sampled coarse and fine woody debris and just coarse woody debris on the remaining 15. So what's a little bit difficult about line intersect sampling is when to and when not to include a piece of wood. And we followed the Forest Service FIA guidelines here, and we only counted pieces of wood that intersected the transect through the central axis of the piece. It had to be the target size, which I described earlier, 7.5 centimeters for coarse and less than that, but greater than 3 centimeters for fine, at least a meter long and partially above the soil surface, leaning at an angle less than 45 degrees. So when we intersected coarse woody debris in 2004 and again in 2020, we took cookies, slices of logs. We did this for each species and decay class combination that we encountered at each site, the first species and decay class combination. So for example, if we intersected a sugar maple decay class 2 and we hadn't yet seen one at that site, we would take a sample. And in 2004, Marty Acker estimated the density of these samples by water displacement. This figure on the right here shows a very idealized or easy way to do that. In this case, the samples were actually vacuum sealed and they were round cookies rather than a nice wood block, but it's the same idea and measured density via water displacement that way. To sample the twigs, as I mentioned, that's a different sampling method. Because this is such a smaller component of the woody debris, we were able to use a mass for unit area basis. And so we used a 4-meter squared plot for the 16 by 30 millimeter size class and a nested 0.5 meter squared subplot for the smaller size class, less than 16 millimeters. And we used 5 of these plots per stand along the tree inventory transects. So that was a lot. Here's a little figure that should help. So here's our stand, here's the 5 transects. And not always were the transects parallel in our sites, but this will help give an idea of how we did this. Here's the coarse woody debris clusters going in, and then we come back in and sample for twigs using these nested subplots. So what did we find? Well, in these sites across the corona sequence, and this is live above ground biomass on the y-axis here, site age on the x. And we saw that our oldest corona sequence sites seem to be reaching a maximum right around here at about 350 megagrams per hectare. What's interesting is these sites are right next to each other. One of them is pretty leveled off, maybe slight inclines from the previous year. And the other is doing the opposite, decreasing since the previous year. It is, again, interesting to note that the one that's decreasing here, we saw a lot of downed mature red maple this past summer and the previous summer. And so that may have something to do with that. And the live biomass in our oldest chronosequence sites was very similar, or actually a little bit higher than we saw at the bull. But considerably less than we saw at Mountain Pond. And so that was interesting as well. The standing dead biomass that we observed was similar across our 2 oldest chronosequence sites. You can see here, and again, similar from those to the bull, but not quite to Mountain Pond. What was very interesting here was this very large above ground dead biomass at one of our sites, M3. And this is attributed to large dead beech and red maple at that site. Comparing this to other studies, our standing biomass is on the high end of that reported by Keaton et al. And Hoover et al. For live trees. But what's interesting to note about that is their stands that reached that 350 or about 350, if they got close to it, were a bit older than the stands that we had. And our standing and down dead biomass was pretty similar to that reported by Hoover et al. And that was across sites in the Northeast. We did see that the volume of down wood increased with stand age. There's 2 regression lines here, one for the 2004 data, that's the solid line, dashed line for the 2020 inventory. And while both of those R-squareds are obviously show that the volume is increasing, that relationship was stronger across the first sampling period when the sites were younger. And this ANOVA table here is from a mixed model that shows the effect of site age and sampling year on the volume of downed wood. Due to the repeated measures, we were able to see that some of the values we observed in 2004 were indeed a result of, in this case, allogenic events. So this outlier here was a blowdown that Marty Acker had noted in his notes when he went out to M4. And we saw it decrease substantially after in the 2020 inventory. And likewise, this big jump in H3, as I alluded to earlier, was a result of large red maple. These outliers were even more extreme when we converted the volume to biomass, thanks to the density that was higher due to these recent inputs. And as I mentioned before, Marty actually calculated density via water displacement in 2004. And here's what that data looked like. Interesting, you see that the decay class 5 has, so the, these box plots here, the line is the median and the diamond is the mean. And you're probably wondering why decay class 5 is higher in density than decay class 4. And that may be due to the error that was involved in water displacement and decay class 5 material, which is inherently very fragile in nature. And so when you vacuum seal it and then conduct water displacement, it's subject to a lot of error. And we did see that the density did change with decay class. Decay class was very significant, species less so in that ANOVA table at the top right. Comparing our volume and biomass to other northern hardwood forests, our volume of downwood and biomass is pretty similar to those reported by Greg McGee and others from 1999 here at the top right, McCarthy and Bailey's study from 1994, and the study that I've been talking a lot about, Keaton and others, 2011. We did note that twig mass peaked in our stands during self-thinning, which we expected, especially due to the contribution of pin cherry, which succumbs to mortality pretty readily, right around 30 to 50 years in the northern hardwood forests. And these two dotted lines here are stands that were dominated by pin cherry in their overstory. The other early successional stands were actually more dominated by American beech and birch. And that's why we didn't see quite the peak there. The species composition in our stands, both overstory and downed, changed as a function of stand age, as we expected, especially the occurrence of pin cherry. And so on the left here, you see live trees, and on the right, coarse woody debris. And especially interesting to note the prevalence of pin cherry in the downed component compared to the live during this time. And I said before that we were hoping to establish a classification of the downed wood at different stages of succession. And so here I'm putting circles around what would be the different stages that we're seeing based on the species within the downed wood. And so here we have our residual stand CC2, and that's dominated by coniferous wood that was left over from the previous overstory. And then these early successional stands dominated by pin cherry. And as we get to stands about 60 years and older, we see a much more diverse mix, especially of shade tolerant species in the downed wood. And interestingly, our old growth sites had quite a bit more yellow birch than any of our oldest chronosequence sites. And here's a little bit bigger, the progression that we saw of downed wood volume first here in 2004, and then in 2021. I'll go back again and say that one of these sites, H1, was sampled in 2004, but not in 2021 due to a human-related disturbance that unfortunately produced wood that was irrelevant to the study. And here's that again with decay classes as a function of the coarse wood volume in 2004 and 2020. And you can see especially the lighter colored material here in 2004 moving to the right as we see the younger stands contribute more structurally sound wood to the total volume. So I also used a NMDS plot here to determine if these groups, these age groups, were actually different or appeared different on an NMDS plot based on the species, based on the volume within each species of downed wood. And so the variable that went into making this plot is the amount of volume within each species of downed wood at a site. We've got 2 years here, and I'm gonna put some circles around the similar stands. So these are the residual stand from 2004 to 2020. We see more early successional stands on the right, more mid-successional stands, those boxes in the middle here, and old growth sites on the right. And interestingly, there is quite a bit of variability among these, and some of the mid-successional stands based on this metric look more like the old growth stands or vice versa. I also looked at the down to live biomass ratios, and the highest of which was 0.8 in the residual stand, which I took off this figure on the right so that we could see the pattern in the other stands better. Following that massive peak in a stand that really hasn't contributed to the downed wood, we saw greater than 1.0 in the early successional stands. And again, after that blowdown, this previous sample. And this figure on the right is looking at cumulative frequency of diameters of live trees. And so we can see as the stands get older, the trees get bigger. The dashed lines here are the uncut stands to old growth sites. And I used an Anderson-Darling test to determine if there was a higher, if the distribution of stems was different in these stands. In specifically in the oldest second growth stands, which in our case are H2 and H3. They were both harvested in 1875, and the second growth stands. And for live trees, that p-value was 0.09. And here it is for coarse woody debris, p-value was 0.06. Interestingly, the distribution of diameters, this is large end diameters of coarse woody debris, were greater, or were more variable than the living trees. Okay, so in summary, we did see that the downed wood increased with stand age, the volume of downed wood. We did see that species composition was different according to the successional stage of the stand. And what was really interesting is our above ground biomass results. And I plotted them here on that graph that I showed earlier, and you see the steeper slope and the quicker, after only about 150 years, reaching 350 megagrams. So it will be interesting to look into this further and determine how these stands may continue to grow and whether they decline from here or continue accumulating biomass. In the future, in the future, we will have nutrient concentrations. In 2004 and in 2020, the coarse woody debris samples, those cookies that I was talking about, they were digested and ran for nutrient concentrations. And I'm working on visualizing that data for the coarse component right now, and actually working on processing the twigs for nutrient concentrations as well. And then once we have nutrient concentrations, we can use those biomass levels to scale up to nutrient content. And we're hoping to see, or we're aiming to see if the early successional stance that especially cherry is dying off, if this is leaving a distinct fingerprint in the nutrient content of those stands. I have a lot of people to thank for their help in this research, especially Ruth and the lab group for all of their support. I really couldn't have done this without the summer field crews, especially this last summer where we inventoried all of the chronosequence live stands and added the old growth stands. So big thanks to Aaron and April for all of their help with that. Of course, to my committee, Chris Woodall, Russ Briggs, Greg McGee, for all of their support and advice throughout this. And to all of the people that were involved in the previous sampling, setting up the chronosequence stands. Matt Badabonker, Marty Acker, Mary Arthur, and Tony Federer, just to name a few. Thank you all. Any questions?
Monitor questions in the.
I'll pull up
questions from the live participants, and then Mayor Maker, you can monitor the chat window, or if people raise their hands or something like that.
Yeah.
Joe, I'm happy to start off. So thank you for sharing that. This interesting synthesis of a lot of work. New measurements to really fill in some of the gaps in how this succession process plays out. I was wondering, could you go back a couple of slides where you were showing you, I guess, the outcome of your biomass accumulation? And maybe slide 43. Just to clarify that. So you stopped your line B,
yep,
at about 200 years. So does that not include your bull site? Maybe I missed something in the.
No, you're right. I didn't include the bull and pond. So,
actuality, while we're conceptualizing this, that line B should project farther to the right on that extent. Would that be correct?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, if we're including the bowl and the pond in this, then yeah, absolutely. It would expand to the right.
My
point being, I suppose, is what's so fascinating about this, what we've been talking about for a couple of years, is whether or not we have that expected decline, mm-hmm, that Foreman and Likens model have predicted. And so if D actually does project past 200 years, those old growth cut stands, I mean, what's your thought on that question about whether or not you see that relaxation of above ground biomass during that stand reinitiation, the transition?
Yeah. So if I expand this to include our old growth sites, we don't see a decrease. It's very similar in our old growth sites, and in the pond it's actually more. Again, we just have one sampling year there, but it doesn't look like it's decreasing in those sites compared to ours.
So then the other question again still remains, do we have observations at that critical point about where your D is actually on that graph, where it's placed in that time frame? So are we still missing that?
Yeah, we have a gap.
Yeah.
We end at like 150 and then pick up with the bowl and mountain pond well past 300, from what I understand. And so we're missing, yeah, a critical point there where it could be doing any number of fluctuations.
Based on your data.
Based on,
it might be,
yeah,
fluctuating.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Ruth.
I just want to say, because Chris is with us remotely and Greg is here in person, that some of what you did came about because of suggestions from your committee. Right?
Yeah.
So whose idea was it that you need some old growth points in here? That came up at a committee meeting, right? And the comparing alive to dead came up at that.
Yeah.
So I want to appreciate you too.
Yeah.
I'll throw out one question, because I want to hear what the experts have to say about it.
aluminum pieces of wood shorter than 1 meter seems like a bias, and I don't understand why you want to do that. So basically, as soon as wood becomes less than 1 meter long, you're omitting it from our budgets. So Joe, do you have any thoughts about that? And then, I don't know, Greg, you've done it the same way, and Chris is going to say that's the way to do it in FIA. Why would we do that? Is it practically difficult to do it, to get the smaller ones?
I think it's practically difficult, particularly if one piece fractures into many pieces, many smaller than 1 meter pieces. But I agree, it does bias.
Your transect, I don't know.
Yeah.
Chris, why aren't we counting these?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
All right. The FIA program actually now defines the population as down to like zero, because you're right, there was concern about missing these smaller fractured pieces, but we only measure the nearest foot, so technically we kind of measure to 1 foot, because less than half a foot would get round down to zero, so our population kind of goes down to about 1 foot in length. But when we've surveyed like globally what people do, 1 meter is kind of a minimum threshold. And maybe that's derived from line intersect sampling and perhaps, maybe oversampling smaller pieces. I'm not quite sure. But that's kind of been, internationally kind of a minimum length for a while. But the FIA program, like I said, is going smaller, or has been for the past 10 years.
Yeah,
that's, I don't know. If you hadn't included it, you'd be seeing a bias between the, right. You'd have to exclude it when you're going to finish the previous sample.
Right.
Do you feel, Joe, that in the field, practically, that you were disregarding a lot of material on the ground because of that rule?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'd say a lot, but it happened. It did happen where I would run across a piece and measure it, and oh, it's 0.6 meters, doesn't count. That did happen a few times. Yeah.
Anybody
else?
Anybody on Zoom want to ask a question?
Yes, this is Chris. So, just to tag a question to the question that was asked of me, line intersect sampling, I believe its origins is more and more rapid fuel assessment, kind of more out west. It's not necessarily, created for kind of studies such as the one that you used it in, although, I mean, it works out well, but I guess given your experience with line intersect sampling in this study, what were the pros, cons of that technique? And if you could do it all over again, would you use line intersect sampling or try to pick up some, use some alternative approach to down dead wood measurements?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I would like, I really, maybe I'm biased. I like it. Mostly because I've done it a lot. Even before this study, I did it a lot. It's easy to do, especially when you're alone. And I was alone a lot the first summer because it was the first summer of the pandemic and we had a small field crew. And so I was able to stake the transect down to the center and go out. And it was just very easy to do by yourself. I think if I were to do it again, I would probably use line intersect sampling, but include the smaller than a meter component, just as we were talking about. But yeah.
I don't know why, Jim, you wouldn't want to establish plots and measure out all the edges of the plots and try to maintain your orientation within those plots, measure every dimension of the length and diameter.
Right.
You did it. What's your opinion on that?
I would vote for Law there.
I have another question, but I think we should hear from somebody else. Anybody in the lab have a question that hasn't already been answered in our previous discussion? That's our live audience.
I have a question. If you were speaking to foresters about your research, what would you convey that important for them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what's important, especially from a management perspective, is the distribution of stems. And while this wasn't quite significant according to this p-value, you can clearly see from the graph in the downed and or in the live and the downed component, the larger stems that the uncut stands have. And so I think from a management perspective, it's important to maintain, if you're looking to mimic old growth structure, it's important to maintain those large stems on the landscape.
Is Russ still with us? Yeah. Russ, one question before you go off to meet the provost?
No, I like to save my questions for the for the big event. Otherwise, I'll have nothing to talk about.
The presentation has changed since we reviewed it last week, which is kind of exciting. And one of the things I haven't visualized before is how much of the plot is being covered by these three transects. So you skip the inner 1.5 meters, I forget, to avoid oversampling, but what's the length of a fallen log? You can hit the same log, right, with multiple transects. And so what?
Yeah, I guess you could. I don't think that I ever had an instance where I hit the same log with the transect. In the case where there was a blowdown, I think an H3, as I said, a lot of the large red maple had died, and it's kind of like a domino effect in that stand. After one large tree falls, you have several. And I think I might have run across that in that stand where I hit the log twice, and I counted it twice. That's what the protocol says to do.
So what would be wrong with, what's wrong with hitting the same tree twice? I mean, there might be some statistics or tests that assume that these are independent and they become not independent, but do your statistical tests assume that the pieces of the fork, what do you call it?
I didn't make any statistical tests that use that assumption. The scaling up to the whole stand volume doesn't assume that they're independent.
So Chris, what's your opinion of this not going to the center because you might hit the same piece twice?
There's a proof of the issue of these Y transects hitting a log multiple times in that 2008 Woodall Monleon. There's an appendix that has a proof, which is beyond, Monleon wrote it up, he's a statistician, which is beyond my explanation, but it's proof to be unbiased when you have an adequate number of samples for your domain of interest. So the only issue with that is, you know, in a research setting, perhaps there could be some issues with that, but I really haven't operated at the kind of stand scale intensively laying out a lot of these, what we call kind of Y transect orientations. There could be a minor issue, but as Joe is indicating, if that situation didn't happen a lot, then I wouldn't worry about it so much as far as multiple, one log being, you know, sampled more than once with a wide transect design, if that was the question you're asking.
Yeah, I was kind of asking, why are we worried about, what does oversampling mean? And I think you just confirmed my intuition, which is there's no bias in our estimate of that due to hitting the same log twice. Somebody want to say something they like about? Joe, you want to say anything?
I think I have 7 minutes.
What I like about it, I like that you got the density and density analyses done in time for this presentation. That was really interesting.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go with the clay class 5. Is that biased by the species of wood that were in that class? Because there was.
Go back there.
I also want to say your error bars are pretty big. So trying to interpret the fact that 4 and 5 are different on the valid out significantly different might not require some explanation.
Right. That's right.
That one. That's new. That's cool.
Yeah.
They're pretty too.
Yeah.
It looks like instead of yourself.
And right, yeah. Most of the wood was in decay class 3. That we observed. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, thank you.
See some of you next